Hi, and welcome to this latest episode of Sepad Pod. I'm Simon Mabon, and today I have a very special guest. It's a slight departure from our normal fare, but I think a very important one. I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Erwin van Veen. Erwin is a senior research fellow at Klingendahl's Conflict Research Unit. He has done a whole host of really fascinating work, policy work, advocacy work, media work, and academic scholarship on the region. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Armed Organizations and Political Elites in Civil Wars, Pathways to Power in Syria and Iraq, published by Routledge, coming out on the 3rd of June of this year, which is very exciting. But he's also done this really wonderful body of work looking at issues pertaining to peace and conflict in the region. And I thought it'd be a real delight to talk to him about his work. So, Erwin, thank you so much for finding time to chat. It's a real pleasure.
And that is such a warm welcome, Simon. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. I'm really, really looking forward to this and to talking with you about your fascinating career, which is a little bit different from the normal guests. You've not gone through the sort of the traditional academic route to get to where you are, which is one of the more influential thinkers on the region operating in Europe today. So why don't we start by going back in time a little? And what was it that piqued your interest in the region? How did you get to where you are right now?
Ah, what a great question. Well, it basically started after secondary school, where for a variety of reasons, I didn't feel like it was a good idea to start university straight away, and instead I ended up what they now call taking a gap year, and that gap year was spent in the Middle East, basically. So I spent the first four months in Israel, actually, on a kibbutz close to the Lake of Galilee, up in the north. Mm-hmm. And there was still a scheme at the time where you could basically work, do voluntary labor, you know, agriculture, yep, that sort of stuff, in exchange for a small stipend and lodging. And that also gave me a really interesting flavor of Israel and, of course, the West Bank, which was nearby, the Golan Heights, a real possibility to sort of, you know, see it for myself, yeah, in the context of the more peaceful post-Oslo days. And that was then followed by 8 months of travel through the rest of the Middle East to the extent that it was accessible at the time. So it brought me deep down into Iran, but also close to the border between Egypt and Sudan, and, you know, just a lot of experiences. And I think my, you know, love for the region, basically, or for the people in particular, their amazing hospitality, was born in that year. And, you know, later I went on to study, and then at some point, sort of the whole threat around conflict, political crisis, why do they happen, what can be done to mitigate, mm-hmm, their worst effects, came through, and then in my current job, I finally got the opportunity to combine these two things, you know, in some work that tries to shed light on the drivers of conflict across the region and what might be done about it.
Amazing. So when was that, if you don't mind me asking? Because the challenge of doing such extensive traveling is logistically and politically difficult and has been for some time. So when were you able to do this?
This was in 96, 97.
Right.
It was possible to travel from Israel at the time to, let me think, what was the route again, through Egypt, Jordan, and then up into Syria. I swapped my passport in Cairo because it had plenty of Israeli, mm-hmm, stamps at that point. But you can actually take a boat from Egypt to Aqaba in Jordan, or at least at the time.
So I've done that route, yeah.
Wonderful. Then I traveled upwards into Syria. I skipped Lebanon because I was on a bit of a shoestring budget and it was much more expensive at the time compared with Syria and Jordan. Then I spent 2 months in Turkey, basically making an eight throughout the country, figure eight. And I saw most of even the more remote regions in the east, crossed over into Iran, spent a fair bit of time there, and then made my way back into Turkey and ultimately flew home from there. So I skipped the Gulf, basically. That was a shame. Iraq was difficult because of the,
yeah,
Hussein regime at the time still. So, mm-hmm, that was a non-starter too. But for the rest, it was all good.
Ah, fantastic. That sounds like a really fascinating trip. But of all the places to go, when you were leaving school, why was it that you decided that, that the Middle East was a place to spend time?
Well, to be honest, it was a bit by chance, in the sense that, you know, being 18 and listening to what's going on around you, I first tried to go to Australia. That was way too expensive, so that was a bit of a non-starter. Then I applied to go to a friend of the family who is a missionary, surprisingly maybe, in Kenya, who works among the Maasai and does a lot of developmental work, but he thought it was too dangerous, basically, so he didn't want me to go. And then I got wind of this kibbutz scheme where you could basically, you know, work your way for some lodging and meals, etc. And, of course, Israel has a huge, you know, historical but also religious attraction. So that was then the plan that ultimately emerged.
Fantastic. God, that's really interesting sort of accident, I guess, quirk of... Yeah. Fate that's led you on the path that you've gone on to. So you went to university and you studied something slightly different from the route that you're now on. So just tell us briefly, what were you doing at university, and how has that sort of helped you with your career that you've gone into now?
Well, what I primarily did was translated, it would be like public administration and public policy, with a heavy focus on international relations and the EU in the sort of master part of the studies. So that, I mean, it basically did what every study does, right? It really gets you to think more in a more rigorous way, a bit more analytically. It trains you to articulate yourself properly, to build up a decent argument, to get to terms with sources and those sort of things. I mean, substantively, I guess it's one of these building blocks that sit in the background of your mind with, you know, a lot of content knowledge about relatively abstract issues. But that was okay. I think most of the practical stuff that you need to perform in a professional environment, you acquire later.
Yeah.
But what is interesting is that I then later, you know, added some other building blocks to that. In the College of Europe, it was much more about the European Union and how it functions. And I also spent some time at Cranfield University in the UK, you know, basically to think about security sector reform and security sector management. And these just contributed all different bits of the puzzle, or the frame of mind, rather, by which you see the world, right? So what's been very useful, I think, is that these are just different disciplines, different areas of thought that are related but different. And I guess it's gotten me a bit into the habit of trying to look at things from a more multidisciplinary perspective, if you can put it like that, with a strong focus on sort of geopolitics, comparative politics, and international affairs kind of thinking, which has its limitations, of course.
Yeah, it does. But I can see how that would all sort of fit together in the work that you're doing. So for people who aren't all that familiar with the stuff that you do, you've got this really fascinating approach to looking at the region, which is, I guess, inspired by these different sort of disciplinary backgrounds, the interest in people and peace and a sort of a normative aspiration for things to be better, whilst at the same time focusing on the more traditional understandings of security and security sector reform. And that comes out in the policy pieces that you've been writing for Klingendahl and elsewhere, but also in the book that we'll talk about in a minute. And I think that's a really interesting approach that isn't always adopted by others who tend to focus on one rather than the other. So how do you reconcile those two slightly divergent streams in the work that you're doing?
Well, as you said just now, I think, you know, one is a bit more ideational or more aspirational, maybe, whereas the other strand is, you know, used closer to reality. So let me clarify that a little bit. I think, you know, the reality is obviously that the Middle East is a region that is dominated by a lot of tense relations between countries, which are then nested in oftentimes much deeper networks of connectivity between people or groups, right? And there is friction between these two, and all of that is overlaid by the usual sort of geopolitics in the role of the United States in particular. So, you know, that's sort of the traditional way, I think, of analyzing much that goes on in the region. But for me, and this is not specific to the Middle East, I would apply it to any other area of study, at least from a conflict perspective. There is, of course, the issue that, you know, like, how is it possible that we as humans engage in so much violent conflict? And the Middle East is just a region that happens to have a lot of it for different reasons. And, you know, how do the political and structural forms of organization and motivation and mobilization get people to actually commit things that are quite gruesome in the end, right? And this is going to sound terribly naive, but so I think from a research perspective, I feel that, you know, I have a responsibility to basically understand what is going on in terms that matter locally, right? Like where the conflict is actually taking place, not through some Western frame or some other frame that, you know, is imposed from the outside, but basically in terms of how do people experience the tensions, the threats, the perceptions that they have, and why does that prolong some pretty awful things? And then, of course, second, there is the question, what can be done about it? And there, because of my position in terms of, you know, where I live and how I've been educated, etc., and who our audience is at Klingendaal, policy-wise, I tend to come up more with, you know, what can the UN do, what can the EU do, the Dutch government, etc., more than what governments in the region might be able to do, because I'm less familiar with them and also don't feel that would be quite correct to make recommendations in that direction. But on balance, you know, what we hope to combine, or what I hope to combine in my work, is a sound sense of, you know, the situation sort of over there, right? What are the dynamics as they're being felt and how they play out? But then combine that with some ideas on how, shall we say, at least European actors, or maybe also places like the United Nations, might make their good offices useful to, you know, reduce, mitigate some of the worst human fallout, the damage that occurs as a result of some of these conflicts.
Yeah, I think that's really well put. And while you were speaking, I was reminded of the essay that you published in the Cairo Review earlier this week, I believe, which is titled "In Darkness, All Is Black: Exploring the Realities of Violence by the Israeli State and Hamas." Yeah, it was published on Tuesday, according to the site, which looks at the sort of the ethical questions about violence perpetrated by the various parties involved in a conflict. And I think that it's a wonderful essay, a bleak essay, a dark essay, but it really captures the things that you were sort of getting at in what you've just said, and this interplay between the different ways of thinking about the region through the ways in which the lives of those living there are affected.
Yes, I mean, I'm glad you give the essay a quick shout out. It was a very difficult piece to write, actually,
of course, I'll
share you the detail of to how many reviews it went. but, you know, ultimately what I was really bothered by at some point is how, and this is especially a problem in the West, of course, how Israel is sort of, Israeli state, I mean, is put on some sort of pedestal, right? As if it has some right to be and some right to defend itself that is cast in marmor without any consideration of what's going on around it and what's going on with the people, in this case, particularly the Palestinians, who live on the same territory. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, the Israeli state exists, and that's just how it is. So I don't want to detract from that at all. But I do think that the moving conception of what actually is the Israeli state in the territorial sense is bereft of any empathetic consideration of of what goes out, what goes around for the, you know, around 6 million Palestinians in the area. And then if we take a look at how that actually, how that control and dominance that Israel has managed to establish is maintained and exercised, we inevitably must have a look at how it uses organized violence, right, to impose its writ, essentially.
Yeah.
And then the events after the 7th of October, and in particular the wholesale destruction of Gaza, I think, do something very peculiar. On the one hand, Hamas has been rightly condemned, I think, for the slight recklessness by which it attacked Israel and everything that happened afterwards. But on the other hand, we see the Israeli state callously engaging in industrial-scale violence and destruction. That just puts the question on point, what's actually the difference, right, between the use of violence between these two parties? And so in the piece, I develop a few standards, legal, political, operational, to try to come to terms with that question, ultimately concluding that, broadly speaking, there is more similarity than difference in how they use violence. And that points us then to two big policy implications. One is that, you know, Hamas has been, you could say, rightly sanctioned for some of the ways in which it has used violence, but the Israeli state has not. And so if the use of violence is comparable, the Israeli state should also be sanctioned, because otherwise the consequence is that you tilt the playing field against peace instead of in favor of it. And the same applies for the exclusion of Hamas from peace negotiations in the past, which, you know, obviously will make them fail given the importance of this group. But such exclusion has not been extended to the Israeli state, even though its use of violence, according to my argument in the essay, is more or less comparable. So that's really problematic. And these are not comfortable insights. They're certainly not mainstream. But I think that argument is worth making, and then, you know, thinking through in terms of what does it mean for the prospects for peace, and in particular for Western policies.
And it goes very much against the grain of analysis in Western policy circles. Not so much public discourse, which I think has shifted over recent months, but certainly official statements, official stances on Israel. So in one respect, it's a brave piece to say and to publish. And as you say, it does go against the grain of most analyses of the conflict and the violence that's been used by more sort of traditional policy actors.
Yeah, that's true. And just to avoid any misunderstanding, I mean, I'm not, this piece is not justifying the use of violence by anyone. I think we should be properly abhorred by, you know, both how Hamas uses violence and how the Israeli state uses violence. That's really not the point of the essay, to glorify any type of violence, but it is more to invite sort of the intellectual rigor, you know, what should we actually do if the violence that's being used by these two parties is more or less comparable, right? Mm-hmm. Does that suggest that we need to treat them in a comparable manner if peace is to be advanced somehow? And so, no, that is not a common argument at all. But I think, you know, the Israeli state has done itself a real disservice in a sense on so many levels after 7 October. But one of them is to basically, you know, react in such a disproportionate, destructive and violent way that what used to be possible to deny before has now become, you know, a reality for everyone to see. Because the logic, the structural drivers, and the ambition, or the aspiration of the violence that we see in Gaza today by as exercised by the Israeli state was always there, right? Since sort of 67 in the occupied territories, and arguably even at the foundation of the state of Israel to some extent. But you could sweep this under the carpet for a long time because it was not so visible, you know, it was much smaller scale, more gradual, more incremental, hidden behind a really professional PR operation. And of course, the Palestinians have on many occasions not done themselves any favors in terms of the quality of their leadership and mobilization through the Fatah and the Palestinian Authority. But, you know, what we see in Gaza is just such a much bigger version of what has been happening all along that it forces a reckoning, at least in Western public opinion, media coverage, and hopefully at some point in how political elites engage with the Israeli state.
Yeah, so with that in mind, I do urge people to have a read of this piece, because I think it's a really important set of reflections and ruminations. Owen, let's talk a little bit about the book that's coming out. And this has been a real labor of love, and I've been fortunate enough to read various parts of it in advance. And it's a really interesting deep dive into a whole host of issues. But for people who've not been fortunate enough to read advanced parts of it, can you tell us a bit about what you're trying to do in the book, please?
Yes, yes, with pleasure. And in fact, I'd like to start by thanking you on the record, as I do in the acknowledgement, of course.
That's very kind.
Quite a lot of your feedback has been extremely helpful, to put it mildly. So the book, well, basically it tries to put three puzzle pieces together in a way. One is sort of the extremely large literature that exists around civil wars, right? And the growing insight, I think, that civil war is not like an on-off phenomena, but is often long in the building, in the build-up phase, and, you know, slow to disappear, which could then trigger things like conflict recurrence and so on. So these sort of neat delineations of civil war, starting year X, terminating year Y, you know, that's fortunately been dispelled to some extent. And the second puzzle piece is the whole much more emergent literature on political settlements, right? Like, what is basically the power structure of how a country is run, and who does the running, and how do they relate to each other, what are their sources of, you know, political, economic, etc. power. And then third, the bit that has always caught my interest most is, you know, what to make of this incredible diversity of armed groups that run around in so many different conflicts, right? Every shade of gray you can find. And so as a team at Klingendahl, we spent a few years basically analyzing the Syrian and the Iraqi civil wars, right? So Syria from 2011 to today, and Iraq sort of 2014 with the rise of Islamic State until 2017. And so what the book tries to do is to basically develop some thinking around how and why do armed groups, which often, you know, double up as political parties or social movements, how do they use violence in the protest, in the process, I'm sorry, of sort of power acquisition, state development in times of civil war, right? So civil war basically provides an opportunity for armed groups to increase their power base, because the previously existing arrangements of rule, the political settlements, they degrade in most cases. They become weaker, and so that creates opportunity. But it's not the case that these armed groups immediately become rebels or something like that, right? That they basically take the contrary position to the government. No, what the book looks in particular is are groups that try to straddle the boundary, right? So I use the term hybrid here, although that might sound like something of the previous decade, maybe. But that's just a shortcut way of saying that they compete and collaborate at the same time with their peers in government, you know, from the pre-existing political settlement. And in that way, they seek to increase their power base. And if they're successful, they'll probably, you know, go back to, you know, being fully fledged partners of that same governance setup that existed before the conflict. So the book takes a look at a few different groups and the political settlements in and how they evolved in Syria and Iraq, and then tries to put all of that together in some thoughts on, you know, so what, right? Like, what does this mean for how we should engage with these groups? What does this mean for prospects of state development and so on?
So what? To lift from your previous answer, I mean, what are the things that we can take out of this then?
Well, that's a really good question that I'm not gonna be able to answer in full here because
you're teasing us. It's a good way of encouraging the book.
It's also an exploratory piece of research, to be perfectly honest. But I think one of the interesting findings is that I think the changes, what I call in coercive profile of these groups, right? Like basically against whom and for what purpose they use force, they are long in the making, right? They don't happen overnight. But they can happen fairly regularly. They can happen once every X decades. It really depends on the context. But so the book tries to isolate, at least tries to make a start with isolating some of the factors that make that possible, right? These shifts in coercive profiles. And so the allegiance, basically, or the disposition that these groups display towards other political armed actors and so on. And so one of the factors that is very important, which will not surprise anyone, I think, is sort of the level of trends and international support that these groups get. And so that's a lever of influence, right? To get a handle on how these groups might shift and how they might behave. And this is really in stark contrast with the usual practice as it stands at the moment of international peacekeeping and peacemaking, because that's often delineated by national boundaries, right? So peacekeeping missions get sent to, I don't know, the Congo, political mission to Yemen. But there is nothing that encapsulates the region as a whole or the countries involved from a trans or international perspective. And so this is not like a new finding, I think, because it's several people smarter than me have made it in the past, but it does put the onus on the need to reform practices of political crisis management, peacekeeping, whether it's done by the UN, the EU, the Arab League, or some other party, to take account of that, more regional part in the equation. So that, for example, is one interesting point, I think, that emerges from the conclusion.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting, and I remember when reading various parts of it, I was prompted to ask a whole host of questions, and it provoked a lot of thought in directions that weren't necessarily the focus of the book, which I always think is a sign of a really interesting tome, that it raises all manner of thoughts and questions beyond the scope of what you're trying to do. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing the book out in print, and to hearing how others receive it, because I do think it's a really valuable project. It builds on a whole host of research that you've conducted over the past decade or so, and it's a really, really valuable contribution. So congratulations, first of all, and all the very best for the publication. It's been a real pleasure chatting with you, Erwin. I've learned a lot from our conversation, as I always do when we chat. So a huge thank you for finding time to talk with me just now.
That's a real privilege, Simon, and thank you. You can be sure you'll be the third person to receive a copy of the book after my father and my director. So that's in the pipeline. And it's a real privilege, and I feel very fortunate to have joined the SEPAD crowd, because it's just such an amazingly diverse set of scholars and researchers that. It's really the kind of place, I think, where you bring different perspectives together to come to frame issues in a different light that opens the door to new solutions, right? Or to at least suggestions for new solutions on how more peaceful and more productive national development might occur across the region. So thank you very much again, and I look forward to continuing those conversations.
Well, thank you, Erwin, and I do too. It's wonderful to have you in our broad collective, and I look forward to seeing where the conversations take us in the coming months and years. So a huge thank you again to Erwin. As always, a huge thank you to you for listening. Until next time.